picture which we like to see, sort of theoretical high energy theoretical physics having an interesting things to say about sort of non-traditional systems from a high energy point of view. But nevertheless, we can implement tools which have been very well developed. We can extend these tools. They're very interesting mathematically and physically. And I'm going to try to share one of those results with you right now. So there's the title of the talk. This is work done with these four wonderful people, and I've had many conversations with many others, so their input is implicit here. And a final note before I begin, the paper, which outlines all of these things and has taken us quite some time, will actually be appearing on the archive later this afternoon. So obviously the timing is not a coincidence, but it's done. So I don't have the archive number, but email me and I can show it to you, or you can just check out the internet tonight. So without further ado, I'll begin. So this is a quick outline of what I want to discuss. So I'd like to review the coset with space-time symmetry breaking. The coset in the context of space-time spontaneous symmetry breaking, which Ricardo basically left for me to describe all the details and make it perfectly crystal clear. And I think after the last couple years, even though people have been thinking about these issues for literally 40 years from the first sort of seminal papers on this topic, I think we have a much nicer picture. And then I'm going to discuss how you can view general relativity from this perspective. Not that it's the best way to view general relativity, but it's the right way to view general relativity in order to couple the systems which do spontaneous breaking of space-time symmetries, which I'm going to try and nicely illustrate with these final two examples. The point particle coupled to gravity, when I write down the effective action, no one's going to be very impressed, right? That's probably the first thing that anyone sees in any sort of high energy theory course. Now, spinning objects coupled to gravity, classical spinning objects coupled to gravity are much more subtle. And in order to derive an effective field theory for them, it takes much more thinking, in part because if you're really smart, you can always bypass all of this stuff and just write down the full sort of Lorentz invariant action. But it's nice to have a concrete, almost, turn the crank procedure, where you just have to have intelligent input at the very beginning, and then you turn the crank, and then you get exactly what you want out. So that's what I'm going to try and describe. And well, yeah, exactly. You don't want to have to be smart all the time. You want to be smart once, and then we're good. And so naturally, of course, there'll be a sort of an implicit high energy bias in terms of notation and all those other things, which I apologize for, but please interrupt me if anything is not clear. And one final note about notation. In general, I'll use, in terms of indices, I'll try and use sort of A, B, C, etc. for sort of local Lorentz indices, and like I, J, K for the spatial local Lorentz indices, and mu, nu, etc. for space-time indices, so on the full manifold. Okay, so just because there'll be a lot of A, B, mu, nu, etc. type stuff, and that's what I mean by the difference. Okay, so let me begin with my first threat up here. So how do we discuss spontaneous breaking of space-time symmetries? How do we build the action which is sort of secretly invariant under the full symmetries, which makes sort of the symmetries which we spontaneously broke implicitly manifest? Okay, so where we start is we start from some group G, and it's spontaneously broken by some vacuum expectation value or order parameter to another group H, which includes in here are some space-time symmetries, and in here also can be some other space-time symmetries. And presumably, because we're having this discussion, we're also breaking some of those. And we're gonna separate H into two pieces. So we have H0, and then we have the unbroken translations P bar. this notation will come up in just a moment. And we can classify the generators of G in this way. So we have X, which are the broken generators. We have P bar A, which are the unbroken translations. And then we have TA, which are other broken generators. Sorry, excuse me, these are the unbroken generators. These are the other unbroken generators. So I'm making a distinction here, which seems unusual, but we'll realize that it's crucial for the construction. Okay, so these two symmetries here are realized nonlinearly on the Goldstones, and so we want to build an action which incorporates all of this. Okay, so in order to do this, we begin from the coset construction of Cowan, Coleman, West, and Zimino. And this was extended for space-time symmetries by Volkov and Oyabetsky. And I think these papers are around 1974, plus or minus a year. And so this is what I mean by this field is really 40 years old. Okay, so we're going to parameterize the coset by this. So my unbroken generators are XA. And then I have my, excuse me, I made a mistake. We're non-linearly realizing these two. Okay, so I have left in here, which is unusual if you do the coset construction for internal symmetries. I've left in here the translations, which are going to be non-linearly realized. But if we were doing internal, only the spontaneous breaking of internal symmetries, we could have left this in here all along. As you'll see from the formalism, it just sort of goes along for the ride and ends up giving you just a trivial sort of Kronecker delta. So you can always include this, so it's not like we're doing some sort of violence to the original formalism. And then here is sort of the familiar piece where we have Goldstones associated with all the broken generators. And these generators can be internal generators. They can be space-time generators, no problem. Okay? So we have this. And the first thing that we can do is we can figure out how these Goldstones, which we have sort of defined by how we parameterize our coset, we can figure out how they transform by acting on some group element and rewriting it in this form again with the, unbroken translations, and then the broken generators times some unbroken piece, so some exponential of the unbroken generators T. And this, performing this manipulation will tell us how these Goldstones transform explicitly. So if you're interested in this information, you can do this, okay? Now, what we want to do, sort of the trick that Cowan, Coleman, West, and Zimino taught us, is that if you consider the Mara-Cartan form, or the components of it, right, you can write it this way. A, and then what index do I use here? Okay, we can just write it this way. So it's some algebra valued one form. And what's important is that the objects in here transform precisely in the way that I would like them to, so that I can now build a G invariant object by using the residual unbroken symmetry H naught. Okay, so just using this procedure, we can see exactly how all of these components change. And we find, in fact, that this thing here behaves like a Feuerbein, a tetrad. And this sort of puts a little bit of light on why we have sort of this funky parameterization of our coordinates. Because, for instance, imagine that we were actually doing this procedure and we used for our space-time coordinates on our manifold. We're parameterizing our manifold with some coordinates x mu. Now, these could be cylindrical, they could be spherical, they could be whatever. But we don't want these coordinates to be associated with actual Cartesian shifts. And so these y's are like in some local little space here. They're the local Cartesian coordinates there. And so this e mu a, say I was doing just internal symmetry breaking, this would just give us the Jacobian from going from the space-time coordinates to the local Cartesian coordinates. Okay, so a little bit of that. Now, moreover, this object here transforms under a G transformation. It transforms like some representation of H. So nabla pi schematically goes to some H of nabla pi, where this guy is some representation of an element in the unbroken group. And so we can use the residual symmetry to build objects out of these things here, which will be explicitly invariant under H, H naught, and will be secretly invariant under the full original symmetry group G. This object here transforms like a connection. So sorry, because of this transformation law, we say that these things are the covariant derivatives of our Goldstones. This term, on the other hand, transforms like a connection. And so you can define a covariant derivative with this connection, which you can act on these sort of linear, if you will, covariant derivatives or single derivative on the Goldstone field. So I build this object and I can take further derivatives of nabla pi. So the definition of this guy is, you can see sort of from the construction here, is just going to be given by E inverse A mu D mu plus, A B DB. Okay? And so with this object, we can take further derivatives of this. Moreover, if we have some matter sector, we have some other fields which transform in some representation of the unbroken group H naught, we can also act with derivatives here, which contain, our Goldstones are contained in here, and we can take further derivatives of that as well. Okay, so now to build a fully invariant action, say we're in four dimensions, V plus one, we take the determinant of E, since it's our Feuerbein, this is gonna be our nice covariant measure. And then we have a Lagrangian, which is a function of my, what index did I give this guy, alpha, of my covariant derivatives of my Goldstones. And then I have further derivatives of this further covariant derivative here. And I just take the most generic Lagrangian built out of these objects, organized into derivative expansion, where I have contracted all the relevant indices, which will transform like some representation under H naught, that is, so that it's invariant under H naught. So maybe this seems a little abstract right now, but we'll see how in the point particle case, all of this sort of becomes quite clear. So actually when you're doing examples, it's pretty straightforward. Okay, so nothing here really looks any different than the usual Cowan-Coleman-Wessimino procedure, except for this piece here, but doesn't look too scary. It seems like we know how to deal with it. So at this point, there doesn't seem to be much mystery. Okay. So now let's consider our point particle just for a moment, and then we'll go back and analyze it fully. So for the point particle, what is our vacuum expectation value? Well, we have some object just sort of sitting at the origin, and it just stays there for all of time. So from a space-time perspective, it just is sitting somewhere, and it goes along, right? This is t, this is x. Okay, so this state which certainly is not very exotic, spontaneously breaks space-time symmetries of space-time symmetries. Sorry, not very useful. But what are we breaking? Well, we're breaking certainly translations because the object is here rather than there. So PI are broken. We're also breaking boost because the object is sitting there as opposed to moving at some finite velocity. So KI are broken. So these are my broken generators. And then we also have some unbroken symmetries. For instance, my three-dimensional rotations, JI, if this object, let's put it at the origin for convenience. If this object is at the origin, I still have this unbroken three-dimensional rotation. And then I also have an unbroken time translation. Okay, so nothing too exotic. Now, the first thing that's disturbing from a sort of relativistic Goldstone's theorem perspective, as we've heard from many people this week so far, is that we seem to be overcounting our Goldstone boson. So here we would say we have six Goldstone bosons, which certainly isn't the case, because if I have a free particle, I have 3 degrees of freedom. So what's going on? Okay, so somehow we have to eliminate these extra degrees of freedom. Let me, how am I doing on time? Okay. Sorry, excuse me? Sorry, if I'm just sitting at the origin, why doesn't it preserve? Yeah, no, if I'm not, then I have to play some games where I basically move it to the origin first, and so, yeah. Similarly, if I, instead of looking at a point particle sitting there, if I look at a point particle moving, I just have a more complicated symmetry breaking pattern, but it just amounts to essentially doing a boost back to the origin. So this captures all the physics. Okay, so leave this down. So what's going on? Well, it's noticed by many people in a variety of, phenomena was noticed by many people in a variety of different systems. Sorry, is that a question?
No.
Okay. The sort of usual procedure, which at this point seems not particularly physical, but is something that we're at least free to do, goes under the name of the inverse Higgs mechanism. And basically the rules of the game are that if we see that there is the commutator of the unbroken rotation with some broken generator X prime contains another broken generator X, and sort of as a secret second assumption, that also that X and X prime are not of the same multiplet, so they're not sort of describing, they're not K1 and K3 or something, then we can set the covariant derivative of pi in the bar direction equal to zero, which will give us pi prime, the Goldstone associated with this broken generator, as a function of the derivatives of pi and pi. And in this sense, it's a consistent constraint that we can impose in our theory, which allows us to eliminate the pi prime degrees of freedom and lower our sort of the amount of Goldstones that we initially started out with from this construction. Okay, so this is sort of the rules, and now I'm going to explain why we should trust this. The inverse Higgs mechanism? I'm not sure exactly what's the story with the name. I think essentially because, you don't need gauge theories. I mean, the gauge theories have nothing to do with this, per se, at the moment. Well, yeah. Yeah, it's an old name, and some people actually find it sort of offensive, but it's around. It's around. So for historical reasons, we call it this.
I think it has to do with the fact that when you have a Higgs mechanism, you have, like, say, you have a combination of a nu plus d nu pi, the guy without the derivative, which is the gauge field, eats the pi. Whereas here, it's somewhat the opposite, in the sense that these kind of combinations appear, but the physical guy is the one without the derivative.
There we go.
So in this case, p bar be p zero.
Yes.
And what does this thing mean again? That p zero commutator with some of the broken generators
gives you another broken generator. Yeah. Okay. So for instance, I mean the punchline for the point particle case is that we have p zero, and then we have k, and then it gives us pi.
Okay.
Right. And so this means that we can solve for the boost Goldstones in terms of the translation Goldstones. Yeah. Okay, so this is the rules. And like I said, we can accept this for a variety of reasons. So the first is that it's just simply consistent. So you have a constraint which is invariant under your symmetry, so you can impose it. And you can just work with less degrees of freedom. I mean, another way to maybe think about it is from the effective field theory point of view, where you put in all possible terms, you're just increasing the coefficient in front of this guy, and you're decoupling some fields. Okay, so that's totally fine. Nothing wrong with that exactly, but it's not particularly satisfying. Another way, which is what Hitoshi mentioned, and also I believe Thomas did, is that there is a sense in which these degrees of freedom are actually redundant. And so what this means is if I actually look at my particular order parameter, which is an extra bit of information beyond just the symmetry breaking pattern, if I look at this order parameter, I can actually see that my Goldstones, fluctuations of this order parameter generated by orthogonal generators, are actually going to push the order parameter in the same direction. And so, for instance, in our point particle case, we can see that a time-dependent translation is sort of equal to a boost, right? And so in this sense, the Goldstone associated with translations and the Goldstone associated with boosts are actually parametrizing the same degrees of freedom. And in that particular case, it's also easy to see why there's this sort of one's a function of the derivative of the other. Okay? And this is what Hitoshi mentioned, and you know, you can do it in maybe a more formal quantum mechanical way with currents and stuff like that, but this is also another way to view it. But there's another way, which I think hadn't been necessarily appreciated. So this is certainly appreciated very early on, that's just consistent. You can get rid of what you know you don't want if you're describing brains or point particles or whatever. This is maybe highlighted a little bit later, but there's another possibility, which is that the pi prime Goldstones are really there, but they just have a gap. And so it's consistent to set this to zero, simply because this equation will correspond to the equations of motion for, or some generalized version of this equation, will correspond to the equations of motion of this pi prime. And so as long as I'm far below this gap, I don't see these as, you know, real degrees of freedom. And I can solve for them using the equations of motion, plug it back in, and it amounts to essentially imposing this constraint. And this is important because these, or certainly these last two reasons for following this procedure are completely different physically. I mean, there really is a difference. And you can actually come up with explicit situations where you can realize one or the other or possibly both. So for instance, you can, this procedure relies on understanding what the VEV or the order parameter of your system is. And so it's an extra bit of input in addition to the symmetry breaking pattern. So if you declare that you have some symmetry breaking pattern, you can choose one order parameter or another. And if you choose one, it's clear that this is the situation. And if you choose another order parameter for the same symmetry breaking pattern, you have this situation. And there's actually some order parameters where this situation cannot actually be realized. And in fact, you can prove that that this is really the only physical situation. But of course, when you're working at low enough energies, it really doesn't matter. The effective action is the same. Okay?
What about in the point particle case, though?
So in the point particle case, you know what the VEV is, right? And it's clear that it's this situation.
Okay, so
right?
It's not that the plot, there's no scale, so there's no...
Yeah, it's not like there's some gap for the boost Goldstones, so on and so forth. But, I mean, you could also have the same symmetry breaking pattern of the point particle, and maybe there's some other VEV you can imagine. I'm not sure if you can. Maybe it doesn't exist, but presumably it could, where there is some extra scale, which there's these extra degrees of freedom, which at some energy become realized. I don't know.
Are you gonna
give us an example? Of this situation? Yeah, I can write down the actual symmetry breaking pattern if you're interested. Yeah, let me see, where are we? Page 5, there we go. Yeah, so this situation isn't actually too exotic. I mean, you can realize it for many different symmetry breaking patterns, but the one where this is impossible to realize is that you have an unbroken time translation, which is pt plus mu q, where this is some internal u1. Unbroken shifts are just the usual ones. And then there's an unbroken rotation, which is a rotation minus an internal SO3. And then we have, so this is the unbroken. And then the broken generators are, yeah, Ki, Q, and then S or J. Let's pick S. Yeah, so it's not crazy or exotic or anything like that. And in fact, the way that we, so Ricardo, Alberto, and myself sort of stumbled upon this was that we were actually trying to build the effective field theory of superfluid helium-3. And so this is sort of like the symmetry breaking pattern which you would like to have, and in sort of a relativistic manner. And so we're, okay, so since superfluids can nicely be described by some relativistic field theory and then you can smoothly take the limit, let's try and describe superfluid helium-3 with a relativistic symmetry breaking pattern. And we had in mind that this was the interpretation, and so we couldn't show that this was true, and then we could prove that, in fact, there wasn't this. So it really gives a very sharp example. What is the interpretation of the gap mode? Let me see. I forget exactly. I mean, we can look it up and discuss. Okay, no. But from the sort of constructive procedure, they're just the Goldstones associated with these parameters. And so they're just all really there in the spectrum. Some of them are just gapped.
So. What controls the gap?
So in some cases, so for instance, here I'm not sure if it's exactly specified, but I know in some cases when you have the symmetry breaking pattern, for instance, coefficients like this here, which basically help you with the dimensionality, will sometimes exactly fix the gap. So for this case, is the gap exactly fixed? I forget, but certainly in some of your examples with Rachel, the gap is exactly. I think in this case, I wouldn't say it's exactly fixed here. Yeah. Yeah, but if you send it to zero, then you change the symmetry breaking pattern. So the gap is somehow proportional to this. So it's not that it's fixed exactly, but if you try to send it to zero, you change the symmetry breaking pattern.
So is it discontinuous? The spectrum is discontinuous from nil going to zero.
Presumably, I'm not sure exactly, but. Yeah, but even in this case where you don't have this sort of gauge redundancy where you're overcounting your degrees of freedom, it still makes sense to, again, consistently impose this simply because if you write out the effective action, you work below this gap, you just use the equations of motion. You have some actually a generalized version of this, right, where there's some sort of schematically nabla pi plus other, let's call this pi 2, squared or something like this. You can have some more complicated thing. Also, because you can imagine if I write down the most general action. I can have higher derivative corrections to the leading order equations of motion. But once I write these out, it's effectively the same as solving the leading equations. And just everywhere I see this in my action, I replace it with my higher derivative pieces. So there is a sense in which this is sort of the true constraint to utilize, simply because if I had generic coefficients anyways, the difference between this guy and this guy are just shifting the coefficients around. So generic coefficients to other generic coefficients, there's really no difference. So we might as well take the simplest inverse Higgs constraint. Okay. So that's basically the story with the, yeah.
Is there any sense that this constraint follows from the equivalent motion?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I was talking about. Maybe I didn't make it clear. So if you just take the general building blocks up here, just all of these guys, convenient chord. If I take all of this, just write this guy out. I really maybe could have explained this a little better, but what this algebraic relationship actually shows you, and you'll see that it's a sort of in one-to-one correspondence with the fact that when I build these objects, some of these things will always have derivatives on them, and others will be algebraic in some of the Goldstones, right? So if we look at this, and then we look at how we actually calculate these quantities and parameterize omega here, you can see that you're essentially going to pollute, as I do all the commutators, I'm essentially going to pollute some of the covariant derivatives of my Goldstones with algebraic pieces of other Goldstones. And so that's why it makes sense to solve these things, because they're not differential equations for pi prime. They're algebraic equations for pi prime. If they were differential, then, I mean, I'd have to provide boundary conditions. I mean, it's not very sensible.
Yeah? In keeping with that, I mean, I'm not sure by pi 1 you meant one of these gap things, but you would expect it to be something like the mass squared of pi prime times pi prime.
Yeah.
Stuff, and then pi prime is...
Exactly. I mean, there can be more derivatives of... So here, let's say the Goldstone that I'm actually... If I write this equation out in terms of all the Goldstones, the one that I'm solving for is pi prime, right? Even though there's, you know, pi 1 here and pi 2 here. But this equation has to be algebraic in pi prime, and then it can maybe have derivatives on pi prime. But those are higher derivative effects, so on and so forth. Yeah, the usual story. So you really can, from a constructive point of view, just write the most general thing, look at it, take the equations of motion, and see that you can, as long as you work below this gap, you can implement those equations of motion, and you're going to get effectively up to field redefinitions, the same equation you would have had if you just eliminated these guys from the very beginning. Yeah, I mean, but they could, there's physical situations where they're really there. So it depends on how you want to view it. But from the very, very low energy, as long as you're allowed to go all the way to zero, you can always do this, and then, yeah, you can view them that way. Okay. There's one final piece, which CCWZ told us how to do, just as a quick sort of warm-up of where we're going to go, which is that we know how to also gauge symmetries, in particular internal symmetries, in the coset construction. Essentially, all we do is the derivative up there in the Mara-Platon form, this omega inverse d omega, this guy up there in the upper left, all we have to do is we have to promote this derivative to a covariant derivative. And really, no surprise. And so this thing is just going to be given by I A mu A, what did I use? V of A. So V of A can be unbroken generators, broken generators, whatever. And now we have we have consistently coupled all of our Goldstones to this additional gauge field. Now, if V happens to be, if some of the V generators also happen to contain the X generators, which are my my broken generators, then what I can do is I can essentially go to unitary gauge by choosing I can choose a particular gauge choice such that I can absorb all the Goldstones associated with X. So just as a side note. Okay. So like we said, we can gauge internal symmetries. Okay. Sorry, running out of chalk. Maybe there's some up here. All right, so that's the quick sort of lightning review of the coset construction with space-time symmetries. But I think from my perspective, not much has changed. You have this extra Fierbein, but most importantly, you have this inverse Higgs mechanism. And I think this is the real meat of the whole story. Okay? So now what we want to do is, now I'm going on to threat number two, which is discussing general relativity from the perspective of the coset construction. Okay. So what do we want to do? Well, we want to gauge Poincaré. Right? And we want to non-linearly realize translations. So our parameterization of our coset, which is ISO 31, SO 31, is just going to be e to the I YA X PA. Okay? And now what we're going to do is, now we're going to consider the Mara-Kanton form, where we have promoted the usual derivative here to a covariant derivative, which is defined by I e tilde mu a p a. And now sort of I'm making a difference between the space-time coordinates and the internal Lorentz coordinates, plus I omega mu a b over 2 j a b. OK, so I'm just going to calculate this thing and express it in the form up here, right? And so we're just going to define these objects. So E now without the tilde, PA, plus, I still call it, I over 2 omega mu AB JAB. So it's pretty simple to just do the commutation relations, starting from here, and just bringing the exponentials of the translations through. Okay, and this is what you get with E mu A, which of course has the very suggestive notation of a Fierbein, our usual space-time Fierbein. E mu A is defined to be d mu y a plus e tilde mu a plus, is there 1/2? Sorry, let me check. No. Mu a b y b. Okay. So this is that, and this piece is exactly this piece here. Okay. So we're just sort of following our nose, doing what we would, this is sort of a more formal interpretation of this, but it's just like a nice little generalization of what you would do in the coset construction for breaking of space-time symmetries, and how you gauge how you gauge your generators, how the symmetries associated with those generators. So we just put in this covariant derivative, we calculate these objects, and this is what we have. Okay, so now we want to build our most general action, and our general action is given by the determinant of E. This is exactly what I wrote up there. And then we have a Lagrangian. But here, notice that there's no sort of nabla pi x pieces. So all I have is, I have the covariant derivative associated with this omega, essentially defined exactly like that, except a capital B is replaced by this. Okay, so I have nabla a L. So we can write this guy explicitly. So this is just going to be d mu E inverse, well, The inverse is implied by the notation, sorry, with the up and then the down, and then plus, sorry, this should go there. Yeah. So we just have this derivative. So we have a Lagrangian of this derivative, and then we have this determinant, and then, of course, arbitrary coefficients. Okay? So we're just doing exactly what we would have done before. And now that we have a derivative, this is just like a usual gauge theory where we can make field strength tensors out of this derivative. So in particular, commutators of this derivative, this covariant derivative, excuse me, on some random vector field, we can write as R C D A B V D minus plus. Let's see. Okay, so this guy here will turn out to be our torsion. And then this is the usual curvature, the Riemann. And the fact that these guys have Lorentz indices means that they're related to the usual Riemannian curvature with space-time indices just by applying enough Fear binds to convert all the space-time indices into Lorentz indices. Okay, so here's R, here's T. So it looks like we should have an action which is given by so we have R with, let me make sure I get the contractions right. Yeah. Plus higher derivative term. Sorry, the T's can be contracted in three different ways, so I'll just write them schematically this way. Well, we know how to fix the coefficient of this by matching to experiment, if you will, right? So this will give us the usual Einstein-Hilbert, and now it seems like we've contaminated ourselves with all these torsion terms, and then, of course, you have R squareds and further covariant derivatives of R and all that other stuff. But these are terms that you would expect from effective theory, a la Weinberg, massless spin 2, etc. But these guys seem a little unusual. Okay? So what exactly is going on? Well, R, we know, goes like, you know, there's an omega times an omega, plus there's like a derivative of an omega with various e's floating around, something like this. T, on the other hand, is purely algebraic in omega. So this guy goes like omega, each t goes like omega, right? Which means from the perspective that we were just talking about, where we have equations of motion and we integrate out fields with gaps, so on and so forth, this omega looks non-dynamical. Because if I vary this action with respect to omega, I actually get, basically because of, what else could it be? I get, when I vary this first piece here, I get something proportional to the torsion. And then when I vary all of these pieces here, because I have torsion squared, etc., I get something proportional to the torsion. And so I find that the equations of motion of omega are essentially that the torsion is equal to zero, which is pretty cool. And so we can now eliminate what looks like a totally separate gauge field. So you have a gauge field associated with translations, and I have a gauge field associated with local SO31, and I can eliminate these gauge fields in terms of these gauge fields. Okay. Now, of course, you could imagine, well, what if we also had some coupling to matter over here? Wouldn't this ruin the story? But what essentially will happen is that the equations of motion to matter, so for instance, when I discussed the spinning particle, you can see that I couple to a spinning particle with something that is non-derivative in omega. And so what this means is that the torsion will be corrected by something like a spin tensor, right? Which means that everywhere in my Lagrangian, if I see T, I replace it with the spin tensor. And so I can effectively set T to zero just in the same way that I can treat this as the true constraint. Because if I have general coefficients, and then I use either this equation of motion, or let's say T is equal to spin somehow, I'm just going to, if I had all the general terms, and then I use this or this, in the end I get The same guy, just with changed coefficients. Does that make sense? Sorry, yeah?
Is this related to the textbook sort of statement that you can vary the action with respect to both the metric and the connection and still get Einstein's equations?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I think so. In fact, it's not like, I mean, this whole business with the coset and a lot of this picture is not something that I mean, maybe the exact way that we're phrasing it is perfect for what we now want to do in the next step. But I think especially like supergravity people are well aware of this. This is not, you know, this is not totally new.
I think it's just saying that it's like the Prakini formalism for writing the Einstein field of action. We just achieved that G and the gamma to be like two independent variables. And the equation of motion for gamma basically tells you that the gamma satisfies some relation.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you're saying. The fact that if we vary this guy with respect to omega, I mean, we get t is equal to zero, which is something that totally.
So I kind of remember that you can actually have no zero torsion and not related to the spin if you also have non-metricity.
If I have what? Non-metricity? I don't know. I mean, there's another thing that we're sort of implicitly doing here, which is that we're kind of while we do have general YAs in our parameterization of the coset, right, which looks like we could handle some arbitrary background. For instance, we know that if we want de Sitter, we would have to have some constant term in here. There's some implicit assumptions how we're really gauging about Minkowski, so we're weakly gauging somehow. So if we have non-metricity, maybe that means that we're somehow order one away. I don't know.
My question is that we have different morphisms in this construction because I don't see it in the
code. Well, we have gauge transformations instead. Yeah, but I can change. I mean, the fact that I wrote everything like this, I'm getting Einstein-Hilbert, right? Just written in terms of Fierbinds, and so. Diffeomorphism is there because I'm free to choose my coordinates x however I want, and the form remains the same.
That is coordinate parameterization.
But there's also a local I can choose the Fierbinds to be any local Lorentz coordinates, right? I mean, it should be there. And maybe I'm misunderstanding your question.
No, I think the finite theory is diffeomorphism invariant.
Yes.
Okay, maybe we will.
Okay, sure.
Just about the non-metricity, he's assuming a metric connection because it's anti-symmetric in A and B.
Okay.
Because the Lorentz generator is anti-symmetric. That's built in.
Okay. There's nothing actually stopping from that constant, right?
Yeah, that's true. Of course, then it makes the Minkowski limit where we take these guys to be zero. A little strange. So, yeah. Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't really have that much deep stuff to say here, but I think from where we want to go, we would like to figure out how, in a Minkowski background, spinning particles, they exchange gravitons. So, yeah, from that perspective, I think we're okay.
Well, I have another question. Why are translations non-linearly realized?
Why are translations?
Translation variants. You're putting them down, right? It's the back.
No, but they're always sort of non-linearly realized, even in, you know, if I have a translation, my fields don't transform by some matrix, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So in
the field representation, yeah. But I mean, you haven't introduced any fields
yet. In terms of x, the coordinate, it's non-linear.
Certainly, x is not a vector yet. That's
yes.
True. But I mean, if you think about spontaneous symmetry breaking, you haven't broken any symmetry.
No, this is true. But that was sort of my point, where you're always imagine we were only doing internal symmetries from the very beginning. I think I would still like to include this term, precisely because it means that if I have some group element, for instance, translations. I could take this guy to just be e to the I, a little a, pa, and I want to act on my coset, and I want to rewrite it in this form, and then I see that YA just goes to YA plus AA, which is certainly, you know, nonlinear in the sense that it's not M times Y. So I don't know. I mean, maybe it looks so trivial, but I think that that's the explanation.
Yeah, sure, but he doesn't have any fields. He's just doing the metric transforms, right?
No, it's that non-linear field we already have.
Okay.
Go on.
I think the problem is not so much the Y over Y, just in terms of group language and taking the IS-3-1 simple group and you're modeling out that group. The group of diffeomorphism.
Yes.
It's very well known that extra step is actually quite non-trivial sometimes. But now it works good.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe we can talk about okay. Good. All right, I have 15 minutes more, so let me get to my let me get to threats 3 and 4, which won't take hopefully too much time. But we'll make all of this formalism hopefully more concrete. Okay, so let me see. Let me try and conserve blackboards by hiding things. Okay, so let's talk about the point particle now. So I already wrote down the symmetry breaking pattern for the point particle, but I lost it somewhere. Ah, no, here it is. So I don't need to write it again. So I have these broken generators, translations, boosts, and I have these, I have unbroken rotations and I have unbroken time translations. So what we can do is we can write this, where omega, we're parameterizing our coset by e to the I ya of x, p of a, which really secretly is e to the I y0 of, sorry, this should, if you're being really nitpicky, it's of an x of lambda because we have some sort of world line, some lambda parameter on it. So let's call this lambda. And then e to the, this is my unbroken time translation, e to the I, let's call this pi I of lambda. These are my Goldstones associated with translations. And then I have e to the I ki. Okay, so I'm parameterizing my coset. Here are my Goldstones with my broken generators, pi and ki. And here's my unbroken translation piece, which sits out front. OK, so we're just plugging everybody in. We know what this capital D mu is. It's this right here. OK. And we're going to compute this, and we're going to write it exactly as before. So here's the connection part. Here's the boost. Covariant derivative, here's a translation covariant derivative, and here's my single Peerbein. Okay? So you compute these quantities, what are they? Okay, so I have E and then there's the others, but let's focus on these for a moment. Okay, remember as we were discussing over there that the inverse Higgs constraint for the point particle tells us that we should take nabla pi I equal to 0. Okay, so we should set this guy equal to 0, and this will give eta in terms of derivatives of pi's. Okay? Let me see. So when we do this, we find essentially that, I can't raise this anymore, that written into, if we write these matrices in terms of the actual velocity rather than the rapidity, so beta I, we find that beta I is precisely equal to d0 xi. Okay? And so this means that these boost Goldstones are really nothing more than the boost Goldstones have to be such that I sort of am driven to exactly where my point particle is, because this is the velocity of my point particle. Right? So it's telling me that in my parameterization of the coset that these things are just telling me to sort of boost to the reference frame of this particle. Okay? And so now when I write the action, all I have left is I have this piece, which is in the measure, which is just fixed. And then I have these guys, and now I can take higher derivatives. Okay, so I have d lambda e times some coefficient. Let me suggestively call it minus m plus nabla I. I put another coefficient in front of there, blah, blah, blah. Okay, and now you can do some manipulations because I've really fixed what these boost matrices are because eta is fixed by this condition. And I can actually show that this thing here is exactly equal to d lambda, the square root of minus g mu nu x dot mu x dot nu with the minus m. Using this and just manipulating everything, right? Because the two Fierbinds are going to give me the metric. The lambdas are going to find a way to all disappear. And we can write it like this, which is exactly the usual point particle action that you want, coupled to gravity. Okay? And moreover, this term here you can show is proportional to a mu, where this is the usual acceleration. Meaning it's proportional to the lowest order equations of motion, which are just that a mu equals to 0. And so we can seem to eliminate all of these other terms. So this is the point particle action. End of story. Now, there are some finite size effects and other things which can come where you have higher powers of R coming in. But at least if we take this guy to be Minkowski, it just this is it. This is the whole thing. Yeah, no, certainly.
But that's interesting that you can fix the coefficients.
Can fix the coefficient of this guy, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you can do a field redefinition to eliminate them. And everybody here, all these dots are proportional to A.
Yeah, but if you have external sources.
Yeah, of course. No, then you could. With external sources, it gets complicated and there's more stuff that you can do. So if you have an electric field, it can induce a dipole moment of the object, so on and so forth. Yeah.
No, but then it seems like you're not saying you can fix the coefficients, though.
Of this? No?
Because the components of the sources will have some unknown coefficients.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, you'd have to fix them by some experiment or matching. Yeah. Yeah, this is some arbitrary coefficient.
I'm
just saying I can set it to 0 by a field redefinition, that's all. Okay. So that's the point particle case. And, yeah? Yeah, exactly. And I think that's actually an interesting thing to do because, in fact, we're thinking of doing precisely that. Partly because coupling to gravity, you know, one motivation of coupling to gravity is certainly real, and gravity couples to many things. But, you know, for condensed matter systems, you're not really interested in gravitons. But having a probe, which gives you access to correlation functions, is actually very useful. And so you could even do this procedure, presumably, with Galileo, right? Yeah, I think it's... definitely a good direction. Okay, sorry. So for spinning objects, in my last 5 minutes, so we have our unbroken translations. We have just P0 again. And then we presumably have some unbroken rotations. So if we have the way that you can parameterize a physical body is by putting internal coordinates on it, which tell you how it's oriented. And then I can change the nature of this body I can change the coordinates, but then I can also I can rotate the body and then I can rotate space and I can bring it back. So if I have a spherical body, I have a presumably an unbroken rotation like this, right? And then for my broken generators, I have translations, and then I have rotations. It's rigid at the moment, meaning so the vacuum that I'm considering is just the object sitting there, and these translations are not time dependent in any way. They really are telling me that I can move it this way or that way. So
it doesn't have an extent.
Well, it doesn't have an extent in the effective theory, but we can see that the higher derivative terms. So here there are no higher derivative terms unless you have external fields, etc. And so it just looks like a point truly, because it's really one thing. But as we'll see in the spinning object, there's higher derivative terms which encode exactly the non-rigidity, which is kind of nice. So it's the correction to Landau, if you will. S is some internal rotations. So to make contact, for instance, with the fluid, so you know how you have internal translations in the fluid and then you have physical translations? So it's sort of analogous to that, or even the internal rotations of the co-moving coordinates. So it's precisely the same.
So you haven't assumed anything about the symmetry of the object at this point?
Well, okay, I can leave this guy a little blank and just tell you that it's some combination of spatial rotations and internal rotations. But if this guy's all of the SO3 generators, then I assume it's spherical. But if I just leave this sort of blank and say, maybe there's these, I can tell you what this is at the moment, at the end of the, after I construct all my covariant derivatives. So that's actually one of the useful things about assuming that your broken generators are the spatial rotations, is because then you don't have to specify this until I can track my indices at the end. Because this is really H0, and at the end I have objects with various indices, and so if it's spherically symmetric, I just can track them with Kronecker deltas, right? Or epsilons. But if I have something which is just about some z-axis, then I have to be a little more careful. There's more terms. So it's nice because you don't actually have to specify the symmetry of the object. When you're really building the general theory, it's just how you build the final Lagrangian. Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So let me put it this way. There's the full J. J-A-B. Yeah. Sorry. Thank you. Of course. Of course. Okay, so in the minus 5 minutes that I have, what we do is we basically do exactly the same thing. All we change here is just instead of having eta k, we also have, so here we call it ya, pa, and then we have e to the I alpha j ab, ab over 2. So this contains both boosts and rotations. And there's actually a particularly useful ordering. In fact, let me just remind myself what it is. Yeah, you want to do boost first and then rotations because it makes some of the algebra easy later. But we can just keep alpha here for now. And then we just proceed with exactly the same steps. So we compute everybody. We write it out exactly the same. And to save time, we have this. And it turns out there is no there's no connection piece because there's no way to generate an S from my algebra. So I just have this. And this term is exactly the same. It's just I erase and put alpha. And here I put alpha. But if we arrange things so that we first have the boost and then the rotation, you can write this as first the boost matrix and then the rotation matrix. Sorry, this is where I want it. Lambda of eta, lambda of psi, where this is some rotation. And since it has an I index, you can essentially eliminate the rotation piece. And you see that the constraint equation, the inverse Higgs equation, is still telling me that my boost has to put me in the frame of the particle. And similarly, when I compute this thing, it wasn't actually important that this was a boost, only a boost matrix as opposed to a boost and a rotation. So this piece remains still the same. But we have an additional covariant derivative. We have these nabla alpha ABs. It turns out that nabla alpha 0i is like eta I in the sense that it's proportional to the acceleration. So we can drop that. And so now all we're left with is these. And so now we can add the correction to this Lagrangian. So we have the original one. And then we have this term here. So let's call this ijkl over 4 alpha ij, nabla alpha kl. Plus blah, 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 blah. So this term here, this is exactly where the unbroken symmetry group comes in. And it tells me that, for instance, if I have a spherically symmetric object, that this thing needs to just be deltas. And then I arrive at the usual Lagrangian for a spherical object. Now, if it's some funky shape, then these are just funky parameters. And of course, if we're in three dimensions, we should maybe contract with epsilons. And then I get a two-index tensor here, right? So that these are really just the rotations, the three vector rotations. And then this gives me capital I, ij, which is just going to be the moment of the standard moment of inertia. And now comes your question, which is like, is this an incompressible object? What are we assuming? Well, there's also all the higher derivative terms here. What are they suppressed by? Well, since there's an extra time derivative, there's a time derivative in each one of these things. So if I have nabla alpha to the fourth, it is two extra time derivatives. So the coefficient in front of this term must be suppressed by some frequency scale, which I integrated out. So for instance, presumably it's the frequency scale of the normal modes of the object. And so if I spin this guy at some finite velocity, I should see that I get some effective renormalized moment of inertia tensor, which describes how my object is slightly distorted. And so what this is the effective field theory of objects which aren't spinning too fast. Because if they start to spin too fast and you have order one distortion, it means that you're approaching the actual frequency of the normal modes of this object. And I think this is, at least for me, this is some conceptual progress because I always wanted to understand these things. And I think it could maybe be useful for certain kinds of calculations in astrophysical systems. So it isn't just some purely academic situation. But really, above all, I think it really gives support to the idea that this whole exercise with gravity is not just a waste of time, because something like this would have been very hard to guess from mu nu indices, I think. And in particular, the way that people have done it historically is they have some kind of constraint equation, and they have to make sure that these constraint equations are used. So it's sort of the price you pay for being explicitly Lorentz invariant. But here, it's secretly there, but all the physics is there as well. OK. Thank you.